I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jill Davies. She's Deputy Director of Greater Hartford Legal Aid. She's author of the book Domestic Violence Advocacy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your own history in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault. And that's a field that's been changing quite a lot since you entered it.
Absolutely. I'm actually in my 30th year of doing this work started as a legal aid lawyer and have never left legal aid. Love that as a forum and a place to help survivors and victims. Began working also with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence early on. Early in the work in Connecticut, there was a really large case called Tracy Thurman, all about Tracy Thurman. The police did not respond effectively, and the response to that was really a very sweeping change in legislation in Connecticut, which is now still, I think, a national model. And so the work was not only representing victims, but also doing work with the coalition and policy work.
What happened to Tracy?
She was very severely injured and was found to not be receiving equal protection under the law.
So you have been talking here at the conference of the New Mexico Coalition Against Domestic Violence. One of the things that I've learned from hearing you speak is how much domestic violence victims face challenges besides the violence itself.
Yeah, violence is our focus, of course, and physical violence. And one of the things we've learned over the years by listening to victims is this incredible range of things that they're dealing with. In addition to the violence, and of course the violence is also different for each victim. Some are facing really very high levels of lethal violence. Others are facing less severe violence. Of course, all of it is really important. Emotional abuse is also incredibly important. There are victims who will tell you, you know, the bruises will heal, but what, you know, how he makes me feel will never go away.
Right.
You know, so I don't mean to dismiss that. But on top of it, you know, they have lives. The violence is happening in their lives, and like all of us, they're dealing with economic issues and health issues, and maybe they have an elderly parent they're caring for, or they just got laid off. They're wondering how to make ends meet. A lot of folks are worried about that now. And there are really a significant number of victims who live in poverty. And for them, these decisions are not just about living with less, but really, you know, whether they're going to have the ability to survive at all. And so they really need to think about a lot of things when they're making decisions about their relationships.
And so, I mean, the kind of standard model is when an intervention happens, you encourage, it's usually the woman, I think, to leave the situation and start a new life and be in a shelter and get therapy and put her kids in therapy and all of that. But that's not possible all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly think that every victim deserves the right to be able to make that decision and to have the support and resources to do that. But the reality, as you said, is just we're not there right now. And so then we have a lot more complex set of things to think about how we're going to help her be safer. We have to worry about what's going on for the kids that live in that house. And we care really very deeply about that. And of course, it also makes us start to pay more attention to efforts and interventions that might reduce violent behavior. So we're looking at the person who's using violence and seeing how we might support and really have some consequences there so that there's a change in behavior.
So how do you do that? I mean, let's say you have a person, a woman who's in a situation, there's children, there's good reasons why she doesn't leave the situation, she's not in mortal danger, but it's still a bad situation. You, as an outsider whose job it is to provide aid in one way or another, you really have to have a variety of responses. What do some of those responses look like?
Well, the first thing we absolutely have to do is develop enough of a relationship with her that she trusts us so that she'll tell us what's really going on.
And that takes time.
It can take time. And you know, I think it doesn't always take time. You know, how you approach the interaction with folks who are experiencing violence can be really important. Your tone, the fact that you're there to listen, that you're respecting their decisions is a really way to start off. And we need to understand what's going on for her, how she sees her risks, what kinds of safety things she's already trying. Victims are always trying to be safer. They're always trying to make things better for themselves and their children. There are times when we think as service providers that safety planning starts when we get involved in the family, but that's absolutely not the case. It's when the violence starts. So the first step is always, you know, understanding and listening and seeing, and then building with her things that might increase her financial stability, might support her health and well-being, making sure she's not isolated. If she, you know, has the freedom to come and go, how can we help support her so that she is talking to people who are not blaming her for not leaving or finding criticism or judgment because she's not leaving, but can help support her in the relationship?
How do you work with perpetrators of violence?
That is not the work that I mostly do, to be absolutely honest, but it's something that's incredibly important to me. And I know it is emerging in the field, a much more important focus. I think there's a lot we have to learn. I think we do have some ideas of some of the things that need to happen. We know that culture is important. We know that each person who's using violence is different, that what works for one won't necessarily work for the other, that the criminal legal system interventions can also have consequences, financial and others, for the family. So I would say this is part of kind of the work ahead.
Sometimes there are judgments against women. I mean, people have judgments, or the system judges women who don't leave a violent situation. What does that look like?
Well, it can be really a personal attack. Victims can hear that they're not serious about protecting themselves, that they're somehow crazy, or they don't know what's going on, or they're making stupid decisions for themselves or their children. So it can be kind of personally very, you know, hearing a lot of negative messages, which is, of course, absolutely the worst thing that a victim of violence needs. That's just reinforcing a lot of what they might be hearing from an abusive partner. So that's one set of things. But we also have eligibility kinds of criteria. You know, if you're not ready to leave, maybe you're not getting all the services. Maybe
is that true?
It can happen. And we can also, there's frustration in all the systems when perhaps a woman has tried to leave more than one time and they're kind of coming back for services again because the violence is still happening, and so they need the help. So there can be frustration. There's a lot of negative things that can happen.
What are the circumstances that would make it easier for a woman to leave a bad situation? I mean, is it financial most of all?
I think financial is central. Obviously, we all need money to live. We need to pay the rent or have a place to live and food and healthcare and those kinds of things. But I think that will really be different for different women, depending on the level of violence they're experiencing. But different women will have different priorities about that particular decision. I mean, the decision to end a relationship, particularly if your partner is perhaps the father of your children, you're married, I mean, those are very, very deep and profound decisions that people have to make. They sometimes are guided by, religious beliefs or their belief in kind of their role to help things, to help their partner, to help him change, to help him be better. There's lots of different things that motivate women to stay or, really keep them from being able to leave. Money is really important. This kind of commitment to marriage or family is another thing. But you'll also have, there are circumstances where a victim will actually be trapped by a partner also. You know, sometimes the violence is just so great, the threats are so great, and that he's been so successful in isolating her that she literally feels like she can't leave, that there is nowhere to go, that he will track her down and hurt her or hurt the children. So leaving is a really important option. It's something that we really want folks to have access to, but it doesn't work for everyone. And so, you know, one of the things that I really hope that people understand is that we have to give victims time to make decisions. They need the time and resources to make the decisions.
One of the things that I think is also really important to talk about is, I mean, we have some kind of like after school special movie images of victims. And I'm sure there's some people who fit that completely. And then there's other people who, because of the exact circumstances that lead to violence in the first place, like substance abuse and poverty and all these other things, are themselves not such great people and not so easy perhaps to work with, and they're making their own mistakes, and you have to deal with all of that too.
Well, I think that, you know, all of us have things that are positive things. All of us have things that are challenges for us.
And if we were in those situations ourselves, I always wonder how, yeah. what would I do?
You know, you do wonder what you would do. And I don't think any of us would ever know what we would do unless we were actually in that situation. But there are lots of complex factors around violence. You know, folks are living in poverty, as you mentioned. You know, you also have some group of folks who experienced violence as kids. You know, they've grown up with it. It's all they know. They're dealing with incredibly severe and difficult effects of trauma. This is really pervasive, and it really affects people throughout their lives and can make it really challenging to figure out how to support them and how to help them. Absolutely.
You've talked about the importance of actually really listening to victims and kind of working with them instead of telling them what to do. Tell us some stories about what that's like and how using that approach has affected your work.
Well, I think that when I really started in my legal practice and started listening to clients, and I remember, you know, one time I was dealing and representing a woman who was facing really severe danger, and I remember thinking, you know, wishing like, oh, I hope he gets a new girlfriend. And I remember just kind of the moral shock of that I was actually hoping for that. And it's something that really pushed me to do more systemic work, but also to listen more carefully and understand all that was going on. You know, it's just when you listen, you hear lots of different things. You start to understand the complexity. You can understand that a woman can be really terrified of what her partner might do, but also really worried about what happened to him when he was in lockup last night. That both of those things can be true at the same time, that it's not an either or. And listening has just helped me learn so much, and it's really built my practice, and all the work that we do in Hartford is really based in that sort of listening to victims and having them drive the representation and having us use legal issues and legal remedies to support what they need and want.
Do you find that they sometimes come up with better ideas about what the next steps should be?
Well, let's say one of the main legal remedies we often use is an order of protection or a restraining order. And, you know, I always like to say you cannot feed your children a restraining order for dinner. If they're worried about how they're going to support their children, how they're going to deal with paying the rent, the restraining order, you know, it may or may not keep a violent partner away, but it's not addressing all these other issues. So that's when we sort of try to talk things through. It's also important to listen around the kids. You know, sometimes the separation, if she goes into hiding, it might actually pull the kid away from a coach or a teacher or an uncle or an aunt or someone, a grandparent, who's really important to that child and supporting that child, dealing with all of that's going on in the family. So listening has already also helped us to be, you know, more sensitive and responsive to the kids' needs as well.
What are some of the frustrations of the work that you do? I mean, being in domestic violence and sexual assault for 30 years, you might have your own secondary trauma and just frustrations about the work and the system.
Well, it's always hard to see when someone's in danger and being hurt, and there doesn't feel like there's a good path to helping them to be safer. That's really hard. But I have to say, I just am always so inspired by the strength of the people that I work for. You know, whatever we're dealing with, they're dealing with it times 100, and their resilience, their ability to see joy and to have hope, even in the face of all that they're dealing with, is incredibly inspiring. And I also just see tremendous movement in the work that we've been doing since in the last 30 years. Things have changed so completely. I mean, when I started doing this work, I actually had to explain what a domestic violence attorney was. I mean, no one had an idea what I did. And now it's, you know, automatically people understand, they value it, they understand there's a need for help. And so it's a long time, but it's also an incredible amount of change in 3 decades.
How has law enforcement's response changed?
That's been a tremendous change. So many police officers are engaged in Obviously, they respond when there's a call. They're such an essential piece of the safety net for us. I mean, particularly for the victims who are not able to leave the relationship and end the violence through physical separation. When the police come, they interrupt the violence. They make a difference. They make arrests when that's warranted. They're very good partners for us as advocates across the country in many, many places. I mean, they get frustrated going back to the house, sometimes more than once or several times, and we understand that. And
The house where the violence has occurred.
Yeah. If there's repeat calls, and you know, we advocates feel some of that frustration also sometimes. But you know, I think it's just part of the emerging part of this field, us understanding that that's part of the work, and that the work they're doing is still incredibly important, and that they are making a difference.
What you're doing is, like, the way I see it, it's like peace and justice work, essentially, on a really large scale. And I wondered how you contextualize it into kind of larger movements that are going on in society, whether they be feminism or other things.
I just think that it's a lot of social change work to think about having families be places where all families be places where kids are nurtured, where that's paid attention to, where relationships, their support and respect back and forth. I mean, I work in the domestic violence field. I also work in the anti-poverty field. And I think that both of them are so important, and the work is so meaningful and essential. Obviously, the poverty rate is growing for us in lots of places. And, you know, those are things that we need to pay attention to. And on that side of the work, we also think about the whole family. You know, also the person who's using violence is part of what we need to address to reduce the violence and improve that person's ability to be a really constructive part of a family and a constructive part of a community. There's a lot of work. It's really interconnected, though.
You've talked about having safer as opposed to safe outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, the real goal is to just get to a more realistic measure of success. You know, I think one of the problems with using safety as the ultimate kind of measure is that it's also really narrow. We think of safety as only being the end of physical violence. And, you know, there's so many other risks that we've already talked about, you know, poverty and other issues that are going on for women and the kids that when you talk about safety, it kind of negates that. And then all of the solutions become addressing the physical violence and ignoring all of these other really important issues. And I also think it just, when you have perfection as the goal, it can be really kind of demoralizing. I mean, if everyone just sees it as impossible, then it might be easier to stop the work. And we can't stop the work. It's too important.
Where do you see this field going? Like, what are the next steps?
Well, I think there's the kind of beginnings of it you can see right now are addressing and dealing with the long-term effects of trauma and seeing how that's affecting folks.
And not only affecting the people in families where there's domestic violence going on, but affecting cops, judges, lawyers, social workers.
Right. Yeah, we just, if you do this work, it does affect you and it does change you. And I think there's a kind of growing discussion about how that has to be understood as part of the work, and ways to address that and deal with it have to be integrated into how we train, how we supervise, how we support people. You know, some of the people doing this work are so isolated. You know, you think of a judge is an incredibly isolated person for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, law enforcement can be as well. And, you know, I think it's one of the reasons why we need to work collaboratively and coordinate and talk with each other to support each other, but also to make sure that our real and understandable human reactions to these really difficult situations don't get in the way of us doing our job and don't get in the way of us being the kind of professional and empathetic and effective responders that victims need.
What would you like ordinary people who might be listening to this broadcast to know about domestic violence that they might not know?
Well, I would like them to know that victims are incredibly strong, amazing people. And I'd also like to say to them that you probably know victims and you shouldn't be afraid to talk to them. Talk to them about what's going on. Tell them you care. And also folks who are using violence, they're also, you know, in our communities, they're people we know, and we also have to engage and talk with them as well. So what I'd like them to know is they can really make a difference if they just pay attention to what's going on around them and talk to folks, just use their instincts. I know people are really worried about saying the wrong thing, but I think if you come from a place of compassion and caring, you'll say the right thing.
Jill Davies is Deputy Director of Greater Hartford Legal Aid. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here. Thanks.